Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling-Biru. Hey everyone, thanks so much for joining me for this conversation with the extraordinary actor Catherine Hunter. With her physical virtuosity and singular presence, Catherine Hunter ignites any role she plays. Like the three witches in Joel Coen's The Tragedy of Macbeth, the tattooed madam in Yorgos Lanthimos' Oscar-winning Poor Things, or the domineering mother, Edie Caron, in the Star Wars series Andor. Soon, we will see her in Francis Ford Coppola's much-awaited new movie, Megalopolis, where she stars alongside Adam Driver and Giancarlo Esposito. Catherine Hunter is regarded by many as one of the greatest stage actors alive. A mix of American, British, and Greek, she studied at the prestigious RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, where she trained with, among others, Kenneth Branagh and John Sessions. During her studies at RADA, she suffered from a very serious car accident, which left her with a broken back and pelvis. It was horrific, but also transformative in terms of her approach to her work and life. After RADA, she continued on stage and screen and worked with the highly regarded theater company Complicité, founded by her late husband Marcello Magni, which worked with a lot of physical theater. Hunter gravitates to male roles and made history in becoming the first female to play King Lear professionally on stage in Britain. Here is my conversation with Catherine Hunter. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm really honored to talk to you.
It's a great pleasure, Christina.
I want to start with one of my favorite characters of the movie season, and that's Madame Swiney. I came out of Poor Things saying to myself, I want to see the movie about her. Who is she and how did you prepare for this character?
He's the madam of a Parisian brothel. And we know from, well, based on the book, we know that she's from London and wasn't doing very well in London, but realized that brothels were extremely popular in Paris. And so made her way over there. And in fact, doing research, I realized that they were they had huge themes. And the successful madams of brothels were extremely wealthy and popular, sort of sometimes a little unethical, sort of like mafia queens or something, you know. But the high and mighty would kind of visit these brothels, and they would be themed on ancient Greece or Egypt or any range of things. What Yorgos has created, you know, was extraordinary and quite wonderful in a way. The women, the workers, as it were, look more like something from a Degas painting than anything vulgar. I think he renders them very, very, very beautiful.
And all the beautiful tattoos that the madam had.
Kind of suggests a past. This one based on a relationship that she had with this lover and that person sort of created a history all over her body, which was great fun.
You have the most delicious looking lobes.
Thank you.
Anna. Oh, I am sorry, I drew blood. Here. I sometimes give in to myself when I see beauty, young beauty, for one day, my dear, you will be a wrinkled old husk, and no one will want you either to pay you for it or to have it for free.
I still believe everyone would be happier if we could choose.
An idealist like me, how delightful you are. But we must give in to the demands of the world sometimes. Grapple with it, try to defeat it.
So you believe as me?
Of course. But some men enjoy that you do not like it.
What?
That is sick, but good business. Come with me. My grandchild, sick and poorly and requiring much doctoring. My choice of giving you choice will jeopardise the business. Her health, her life. Do you want that, Bella?
Of course not.
You don't? You're so low.
I thought you were going for my lobes.
We must work. We must make money. But more than that, we must experience everything, not just the good, but degradation, horror, sadness. This makes us whole, Bella. Makes us people of substance, not flighty, untouched children. Then we can know the world. And when we know the world is ours.
I want that.
Now, go and fuck someone and bring me 10 francs.
And you worked with Yorgos Lanthimos. You yourself are Greek, I understand. I'm going to try to say your beautiful name. Please correct me if I'm wrong. I Katerini Hadjipateras.
That's perfect, Christina.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yes, thank you. Yes, my parents were both Greek. My mother from Piraeus, my father from Chios. And my twin sister and I, were born in New York, but then my parents emigrated again. So we grew up from when we were 2 years old in London. And so we're sort of Londoners with a Greek cultural background. We'd go to the Greek Orthodox Church every Sunday, speak Greek at home, but attended a Catholic primary school, Church of England secondary school, and went to British universities. I went to Bristol and then to RADA. So there's a great connection with Greece, you know, but also a great connection with the UK, you know.
Of course. What was it like to work with Yorgos? He seems very playful in his process with the actors and with your Greek origin.
Yeah, Yorgos is an extraordinary person. It's kind of a cliche, what is a Greek, what is an Italian. I think sometimes Mediterraneans are regarded as kind of flamboyant, loud, making lots of large gestures, and Yorgos is contained, minimalist, very intellectual, but also inside you can tell very passionate and playful as well. So we went to Budapest, and there was some rehearsal with Emma and Willem and Mark, and we played wild games, physical games, and he asked us to know the text inside out, which of course for Emma was a big ask, and to be able to kind of say it. He didn't want us to intellectualize. So we never sat down and talked about the themes, as it were. He wanted us to be instinctual. So very wild physical and verbal games, which is fantastic. Apparently, Olivia Colman told me that when they did The Favourite, Yorgos took them to see Pina Bausch and said, "That's how physical I want you all to be." And Olivia said, "Good, you know." You know, in The Favourite, it was hugely physical, and here too, in terms of mean, if you think, I think swine is more contained, but Mark Ruffalo is, and Emma, because of the emotions they have to scan, you know, they're hugely physical.
Yeah, Emma goes, she does the whole gambit from baby to adult woman in just her physicality. It's quite remarkable.
Yes, yeah. And that amazing dance that they do. It's in his psyche, a sense that a story is told, of course, visually, of course, through a very contoured text, but also physically, mm-hmm. you know, which I could really connect to, having worked with the theatre company Complicité, which is the basis of their work. As I say, I connected to Yorgos because he very much has that sense of that you tell a story also through a physicality.
Speaking of that physicality in Joel Coen's The Tragedy of Macbeth, of course, where this is really comes to bear, the physicality of your acting when you do the three witches.
Where's that been, sister? Killing swine. Sister, where they are? Look what I have. Show me. Show me. Here I have a sailor's dove, wrecked as homeward he did come. A drum. A drum. Macbeth.
Which is just thrilling to see what you do here. What was the process of making these witches almost crow-like?
Yeah, so I have to say, Christina, that it was one of the most extraordinary, exquisite, privileged honours that I've had. So Joel and Francis would follow our theatre work. They'd seen Complicité back in the day. This time is with my husband, Marcello Magni, who is my late husband. So they would follow our work, and it was a delight. I remember one of the times I was most excited was when Joel came to New York. I was doing this time a collaboration with a Japanese theatre director, in which I was playing a Japanese businessman. Anyway, a sort of horror thriller. And Joel came, and Francis, and said, Joel said afterwards, I didn't know what was going to happen. So I thought, for a master storyteller to say that was, but anyway, they would come. And one day I was in Greece. I was actually performing at the Ancient Theatre of Epidaurus. And I opened my emails, and there was an email from Joel saying, oh, Catherine, I'm doing Tragedy of Macbeth for film. I wondered if you'd be interested in doing the witches, and that was just
some email. You
know, some email. So we started talking, and then Joel said, I asked him the usual thing. Do you think they're in his head? Are they real or are they in his head? He said, both. And we started a dialogue over about, I would say, at least 9 months. And the great, great provocation that he gave, he said, they seem to me like crows and standing stones. So off I went. You know, when a director gives you a prompt like that, you just go off and research crows and practice being a crow. And but he said they're real as well. So I imagined a kind of what sort of women would live on a battlefield, but of course crows scavenge, and they have the reputation of being harbingers of death, but they're on the battlefield because of the carnage that people have wrought there. And if you go back in mythology, they have the reputation for divination, for diviners of the future. So putting lots of pieces together. And then, for instance, Fran and Joel came to London and they brought a bit of a costume, which was like a sort of a hood, and I bought a black stocking, and I put it over my face and my arms, and I got on the little coffee table and started being a crow, and Joe filmed it, and then he said, "Yeah, I like that." So started evolving a kind of creature. The idea first was that we would train other actors or dancers in my physicality and have three witches. But eventually, you know, we arrived at it would be just the one.
Just you, right.
Yeah, and sort of possessed that she would hold all the text that she was. And so I did a lot of research about multiple personality disorder, or so they were a mixture of a woman disturbed. You know how it is with witches. There's always the history, certainly in England, and I'm sure in the States, is it's women who are outside the norms. The
yes, the ones you would burn.
Exactly, and probably based on just them being different.
Just fear.
Yeah, exactly. So I tried to find a real creature who might want revenge, and then inflect it with this sense of the birds. Because I thought, if people have multiple personality disorder, why can't they imagine that they're crows or stones, or, you know, the imagination can go anywhere. And once we evolved this language, then Joel and Fran, you know, sort of said, would sort of choreograph. We had costume fittings in which it wasn't just, oh, put on the costume, that looks good. So I had to sort of be the witch in the costume fitting. And then I remember Frances said one day, well, there's too much material, you know, we can't see what Catherine's doing. So it was a sort of, it was a wonderful process. I was in heaven.
Tell me if you're uncomfortable talking about this, and I'll completely understand. You had a very horrible car accident when you were at RADA. Did that at all impact your physical acting or how you got into physical acting?
Well, you're asking Christine about the injuries and everything I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a way, I learned to work, that there were great possibilities within restriction, found freedom in restriction. I was playing Lady, we were doing, I went back to RADA, and there was a term with Kenneth Branagh and John Sessions, and we were doing a musical called Lady Be Good, and I was playing Josephine van der Water, the hostess, sort of hostess. And the set design had built, a long staircase, you know, a set of stairs to come down. And I remember, you know, Ken very kindly reached out his arm to me kind of with dread and how she's going to come down those stairs. But I realized that...
This was after your injuries, you're saying?
Yes, when I went back. And I realized that there's a lot of possibilities in the upper body. So I came down the stairs very slowly and just sort of brought into play the upper body. And there's so much you can do as disabled actors or dancers with disability have shown. You know, there are a great range, or sports people. So I've always been overawed with what people can do in the people with disabilities. So that's been an inspiration in the Paralympics, for example.
I have to ask you about your incredible voice, how you've used this and what sort of roles people have gravitated towards in terms of this voice that we recognize so much.
All right. It's so strange because when I was a teenager, I remember doing some evening classes in drama or something, and somebody saying to me, oh, no, you can't be an actor. Your ribcage is too small. I don't know if it was training with at RADA learning how to use the voice. Yeah, I'm just thinking if I'd had a very light voice, if I would have been asked to play Leah, or if that was more to do with having it was a sort of second training with Theatre Complicité, where the premise there was not you should play the parts that you look like. It was you play anything. If you can imagine it, then have a go. So I played children and old people and men. I played a pantalone figure. I played the old shepherd in The Winter's Tale. As I say, I played the Japanese businessman. And then got asked to play Leah, Richard III, in an all-female production at the Globe. And I've always gravitated toward the male parts, I think, because maybe there's more being written for women now, but sort of 25 years ago, the more interesting parts were for men. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's beginning to change.
I hope so, yeah.
Would you say that?
Just your film, Poor Things, is a sign as to what amazing films we can do about the female experience. So I think so. I hope so. We could do with even more.
Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another one of your incredible characters is from one of the biggest IPs, and that's Andor, Edie Karn. What do you make of Edie Karn?
It just leapt off the page. It just, I thought, oh my goodness. I'm always fascinated by a writer's process, and I thought, this is somebody he knows. I think that lots of actors, as actors, we try not to judge the people that we play. So she's an overwhelmingly possessive, overbearing, in some ways, dominating mother who just, a backstory probably of a husband who's maybe walked out on her or something, but just needs, lives through her son and therefore is kind of an incredibly possessive and domineering. And he finds it unbearable, which of course results in a sort of that comic disconnect, you know.
Yeah. Now, I was talking to Stellan Skarsgård about Tony Gilroy and what an amazing writer he is for you, for actors, that and he was saying that there's so much that he writes between the lines, and you can feel with Edie that she is and with your acting of her as well, that she's a hard and domineering character, but you can feel that there's some kind of sadness behind the situation she's in, which I attribute to both your portrayal of her and Mr. Gilroy's writing.
That's right. Yeah, incredibly lonely a woman, incredibly. And I guess one has all known women who's... That was my backstory for her, that... a husband who's walked out and living vicariously through her son, and has somehow landed in values that are, you know, unless he's successful, unless then there's failure. So there's, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about the second series because that's not out yet.
Mm-hmm. We're very curious.
Okay. But there's a development in the relationship with her son's girlfriend. There's a meeting which has, yes, it is.
Implications.
Yes.
What's it like working with, I mean, this is, of course, a huge... the fan base for the Star Wars universe and everything that it has with it and all the historical connotations of this series. What's it like to work in such massive IP as this? And what does Tony Gilroy bring to it?
Tony, at the time there was COVID, so he was stuck in New York, but there would be many, many Zooms. And the brilliant designer, forgive me, My brain is a bit of a
production
frog.
Design
and the costume designer. I'll try and look it up as we're talking. I mean, who was a genius? Because I think his remit was, this is Star Wars, but not. You can be. We're departing. It's a different. There's a freedom there, but of course, there had to be some nod, some recognition of a world that people would have seen, and yet it could develop. And he did an extraordinary work. So our costume fittings were very, very detailed and long, with him finding the right colors, the right shapes that would denote the character, but be of the world. I think it's brilliant work. I'd never done such long, detailed costume fittings until I went to work with Francis Ford Coppola and his designer, Milena Nero. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But and then the look gets sent to Tony. He approves also the hair and makeup, lots of experimentation. So once it's approved, then you're ready to shoot. And before you come out of your trailer, you have to wear your secrecy cloak in case there are people lurking to kind of, they don't want any pictures taken.
Oh, wow. And, like people, the fans or.
Yeah. You have to, like a sort of Harry Potter invisibility cloak. But I have to say, everybody working on it was of the highest skill and greatly devoted. It was also a time of, during COVID, where I think people came with an extra, I don't know if gratitude is the right word, but a joy to kind of come together and make a movie.
Right, after all this. Amazing. We can't wait for season two. And you mentioned your upcoming project, which we have been waiting for, and that is for all us huge Francis Ford Coppola fans out there, and that's his film Megalopolis, which you are in, a massive project. Tell us what you can about this. What is the story and who are you playing?
I'll tell you the origins.
Please.
So I was in Budapest doing Poor Things, and my agent writes and says, we've had a call from Francis Ford Coppola's office asking if you'd mind if we give Francis your email.
You can imagine. You did well.
Well, yeah. And Francis sent me the script straight away, and I stayed up all night and read it, and then we set up a Zoom, and again I'm not allowed to say, I guess, but. So meeting Francis over Zoom, apart from being overawed, you know, thinking I'm in my kitchen, I'm talking to Francis Ford Coppola, after about 10 minutes, I was so warmed, because Francis has a kind of, he's a sort of a genius, huge warmth, huge passion, and told me about the origin of the project that, it was due to start shooting around about the time of 9/11, and because it involved a sort of disaster in New York, he thought, no, I can't do this now. And without being able to give much away, what really impressed me from that conversation and thereafter is that the perspective he throws on humanity is one of hope. And I thought, now, here's a man who, an extraordinary artist who made Apocalypse Now, for instance, and in his 82nd year is putting forward a film where he believes there is hope and the possibility of change. And I thought that was extraordinary. And it's not just cursory, shall we have a happy ending? It's deeply rooted, and not to say that there isn't a recognition of human cruelty and selfishness and all the kind of destructive possibilities of human beings. But that's where the film lands without giving too much away. And that impressed me and moved me deeply and still does.
Can you say who your character is?
I think I'm allowed to say it centers around Natalie Emmanuel is playing Julia, and she's our daughter. Giancarlo Esposito plays Frank Cicero, and I am Terry Cicero, his wife. And so whose daughter, according to her father, is wayward and has a relationship that with the so-called opposition, who is Adam Driver. It's about
a family drama, it sounds like, also, which he's so good at.
Oh yes, and how, and he makes the whole experience a family situation. He's very demanding, and it's not an easy ride, you know, because creatively his mind is exploding every minute, so people have to be very alert. But for instance, I think it was the first week I was there, it was, and this is particularly sad now because of Eleanor's passing.
Oh, yes, I was it so was sad
there. Yeah, 65th wedding anniversary, and he invited all the cast and crew into the studio, and there was wine, of course, his wine. Eleanor told stories about how they met, and Francis did, and we toasted them. Eleanor came on set one day. I think I'm allowed to tell this story. And I was so, they were evidently so much in love. And so we were doing a night shoot of a particular scene, and it got quite late. And this tiny lady sat on Francis' lap. You know, age, I don't know, he's 82. I think she was a little older than
Francis. Old, yes, I think she was 85. That's wonderful.
And it was just, I tell you, Christina, my heart melted. I mean, I had just lost my husband. We were very, very close. Marcello Magni, an extraordinary actor, particularly gifted in comedy skills. I was very happy that he got to speak to Francis on the Zoom. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and a beautiful relationship, you know. And then we were supposed to go to Atlanta to do some ADR. Francis wanted us there, and then Eleanor got ill, and then so we did it in a studio in London, and then with him on Zoom. And then he was so happy, you know, because she had recovered. He said, some miracle, she's recovered. But it wasn't to be. I hope, the same as with my husband, one just appreciates, you know, and is so grateful for the years we did have together.
And the art you made together, both you and your husband and Eleanor and Francis.
Yes. What a relationship. Yeah. Did you ever meet her, Christina?
I didn't, but I was a huge admirer. One of the most important books, her book Notes about the Apocalypse Now, and of course one of the best documentaries on filmmaking ever made, Hearts of Darkness. So, and I've interviewed Sophia, who I'm a huge fan of, and studied the Coppola very much when I went to film school. So I feel very, very much like their filmmaking is part of my sort of human experience.
Yeah.
Considering the incredible performances that he's brought out, be it, you know, Marlon in The Godfather or Martin Sheen, or what does he do with you actors? How does he...
So we did have a short rehearsal process where he would get us to improvise the scenes. And, improvise the whole scene. And he said, who wrote this? This is terrible, he'd say. Say it in your own words. And then afterwards he'd say, That was terrible. Do my words, they were much better. You know, but he would provoke, you know, so he didn't want us to just come to the lines cold. He wanted us to be living the situations. And sometimes he would rewrite, you know, on the day. And he would never, bar maybe the some huge scenes where there were cranes and, you know, in the smaller scenes, it would always start with improvisation, with improvising the situation. So he's thinking as the characters, he kind of puts himself into them, and his direction is intuiting what it's like to be those people. It's an incredible world.
So Megalopolis and Andor 2, of course, coming. So much we have to look forward to with your work. Thank you very much for taking your time with me. And I'm really honored for this opportunity and cannot wait to see your coming projects.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye for now.
Thank you so much to Catherine Hunter. Don't miss the Oscar-winning Poor Things out now. Season 2 of Andor is coming in 2025, and Coppola's Megalopolis is set to premiere in Cannes next week. And thank you so much for listening. Pop Culture Confidential is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.
Hey there! I'm Hannah.
And I'm Audrey.
We are a sister filmmaking duo
and co-hosts of Sleepover Cinema,
our show where we analyze the films that created the collective unconscious of the girls, gays, and theys of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Princess Diaries, The Cheetah Girls, Aquamarine, Cinderella, the one starring Brandy.
We haven't stopped thinking about these movies since we first saw them, and we want you to rewatch them
and review them with us.
Are these movies as bad as critics would have us believe?
Do we even care if they are?
We are always unpacking that very question on Sleepover Cinema.
Check out Sleepover Cinema wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcasts.com.
See you soon.